Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Nikki Leone. Nikki has been here in Chapel Hill, is in her volunteer work as the president of the Board of Trustees of the North Carolina Writers Network, an organization that provides help and encouragement for writers and aspiring writers and for readers as well. But your job in working out of Wilmington, you work for a Columbia-based organization
called
the Southeastern Booksellers Association. And so I asked you, while you were here in Chapel Hill, to come talk to us a little bit about the state of the writing and publishing and bookselling business in North Carolina. And you said you'd do it. And so tell us what's going on in writing and publishing, and how hard a time are the booksellers having during the economic downturn?
Well, you know, like any other industry, I think booksellers are feeling the pressures of the economic stress this country is going through. People don't have a lot of extra spending cash, and they're being very careful with their money. But at the same time, books are one of the more, you know, the cheaper things that you can buy to do for enjoyment. And so maybe it isn't all as bleak as all that. The bookstores that I know about are actually holding their own. I wouldn't say that business is booming anywhere at the moment, but the ones that I'm talking to seem to be keeping their heads above water, which is encouraging news.
Well, you got your fingers on booksellers all across the Southeast. And what are the successful ones doing differently today than they did 10 years ago, and in a way that is making them be successful or continue to be successful when other booksellers have not been able to do that?
Well, for one thing, I think the South is just a good place to be involved in the book business, because it's a storytelling kind of culture down here, and people are interested in stories, and books sort of naturally follow along that. There's writers everywhere. Throw a rock at a writer is what people sometimes say. It's certainly true. It's certainly true in this state, in North Carolina especially. I think the organization I work for, it's a trade organization for independent bookstores. We have more bookstore members from North Carolina than any other state, with the possible exception of Florida. North Carolina is a very vibrant, healthy,
a reading community.
It's a reading community. It's an avidly reading community, I think. And I think the bookstores that are here now, that were here 10 years ago, are just very savvy, good business people at this point.
Well, I see among the successful independent booksellers that they have that there are a lot of events associated with them. And how do events and bookselling intersect?
Well, for one thing, it brings the readers in front of the writers, and it puts the writers right in front of their readers. And bookstores, I think, are instrumental. Bookstores and library events also are instrumental in establishing a kind of real-time, real-person connection between you and your favorite authors. I think events are immensely important for that. And you can't get that from... you certainly can't get that from an online shopping experience, let's face it. I mean, there's really something to be said for actually sitting in an audience and watching somebody who's written a book that you admire talk about how that book came to be. It gives you a personal connection with the book and with the author that is in a lasting connection, I think. And it brings you back to the store, and it sort of strengthens your literary community to have that personal connection.
Well, I always wondered if the people are coming to the bookstore to see Tom X, who's their favorite author. What good does that do the bookstore owner if the person's already bought the book and they already know the author, they're just going to see them? Do they come in and while they're there see other books to buy, or what?
Well, it's awfully hard. If you're the kind of person who comes to hear an author read, you're probably the kind of person who's willing to buy books. And it's awfully hard to walk into a big old room store full of books, with piles of books everywhere, all of them looking, you know, just fascinating, and not pick up one or two of them. So there is that. But also, I think it just is a kind of quality of experience to have this. It's like a cultural center in your community, a very friendly and low-key cultural center that you can go to and have this experience. And if you value that kind of experience where you can go and meet people, meet writers that you really admire or that have stories that really interest you, then you're more inclined to keep going back to that same place where you had those experiences. And so that's one of the reasons bookstores host a lot of events. They also, frankly, host them because they believe in these writers and they want to get these people in front of readers. They want their books to sell. So that's probably the most important reason bookstores like to host events, because they love the writers.
Well, I'm sure that one of the things that you do is to help booksellers make contacts with the writers and help them figure out a way to also bring people into the bookstore. What other things can a trade organization do for booksellers that smooths the road for them?
Trade organizations do things like negotiate cooperatively on behalf of their members, so we can work out either special deals with shipping companies and things like that, that if you're a member, you can take part of. But mostly what we do is put the resources of our members at disposal of other members. So, you know, you're not in this alone.
Give me an example. What would be an example?
If you are a bookstore owner and you have to change your inventory system and you know nothing about computers, you can ask SEBA, the organization I work for, and SEBA broadcasts it out to all of our members, and the odds are of the 300 some bookstores who are members across the South and the 700 or 800 booksellers that actually are, you know, owners and staffers, somebody knows the answer to your question. So you get good feedback. It's like having a university of experts at your disposal whenever you need them, actually.
I'm visiting with Nikki Leone, who is the president of the North Carolina, of the Board of Trustees of the North Carolina Writers Network, and we're visiting with her about her day job as a member of the staff of the Southeastern Booksellers, and I'm trying to get her to tell me her secrets about how to succeed as a bookseller. And one of the things that must happen to you, Nikki, is that you have some of the ambitious readers, people who had a bookstore in their community and miss it, and they are flirting with the idea of maybe going into business themselves as a bookseller. And surely there's some cautions. Maybe you have some enthusiasm to encourage people to do this, but have some cautions as well. If I come to you and say, I'm thinking, you know, we've lost the Intimate bookstore in Chapel Hill, we've lost the book at Southern bookstore, wonderful little bookstore at Southern Village, but we really do need a community bookstore, I'm thinking about doing it. What are you going to, and you're my friend, what are you going to tell me?
Oh, well, I'm going to tell you, well, that'd be a fantastic idea. Actually, a bookstore is like any other business. And I think part of the reason why we have so many successful bookstores right now in this state is because the people who own them understand that it's a business. These are not places filled with everybody's favorite books, their own personal, what they want in their own personal library. These are filled with books that they know are going to sell. They run as a business with an understanding that if you don't make a profit, you're not going to be here very long. And we have some really long-standing, long-established businesses. Quail Ridge Books in Raleigh, of course, I think they're 25 years old now, or they're certainly pushing close to 25 years old. Malaprop's out in Asheville. And Bookstore that bears your name, DG's Books and Gifts, I think might be the oldest continuously operating store in North Carolina. They are celebrating their 75th anniversary. And they do it because they understand that this is a business first, and so that they stock the things that will sell and that their customers want, and they get rid of the stuff that doesn't sell and their customers don't want. And from that gives them a platform to sort of be advocates for their favorite writers. So they've managed to straddle that divide between selling stuff that makes them money and getting people to read the books that they really want them to read.
Well, what are the kinds of things in North Carolina? What is the stuff in North Carolina that sells in bookstores? What are you talking about?
Oh, bookstores carry lots of stuff. They carry lots of gift items, cards, toys, music, coffee. Apparently a lot of them are carrying coffee at this point. But they also carry a lot of things that I think of them as books only because they have a cover and they have pages, you know, like pictures of cats in funny positions and, you know, what we would call gift books and things like that are sort of impulse items, but attractive and relatively inexpensive gifts for people to pick up. And stuff like that tends to make up a fairly significant part of any bookstore's sales.
So these would be
sales.
Maybe high return. You'd be able to sell them at full price and make a little more money than you might off of other books? Or what's the
Yeah, and like? You can count on them selling fairly regularly, you know, whereas your out-of-the-gate bestseller, for example, your new John Grisham book has a specific lifespan to it. You know, it'll sell for about a year, and then it will come out in paperback, and then the paperback will sell for about a year, and then the sales will trickle off. Whereas some of these other gifty items, they're just eternal. You know,
you're saying it in such a nice way, but what you're saying is, DG, if you love books and you want to get in the bookstore business, I've got to tell you something. You got to sell a lot of the stuff that you might not like in order to be able to sell the stuff that you do like.
Yes, basically. You have to sell books that your customers will like. That, I think, is the first rule that I would tell anybody who's thinking of opening a bookstore. It's the books that you like are wonderful, and those are the ones that you're certainly going to sell the best because those are the ones that you're really passionate about. But if you don't have the books that your customers want, then you're not going to do very well. And your customers have their own tastes and inclinations, and you are there to serve those tastes and inclinations as well.
You're competing now with, first of all, with the big block stores, the Borders type stores. And what is the secret to how does a local bookstore, which cannot carry as much inventory as the block store, how does it compete?
It's careful about the inventory, and it stocks only the inventory it wants to sell. It creates a name for itself in the kind of inventory it sells. And also, frankly, I don't know if it's the last time you've walked into one of those big box type stores, but unless you know what you're looking for, it is very easy to get overwhelmed and lost. And where I think independent bookstore does best is they're sort of a filter, if you will. I mean, you come to rely on the store's taste and judgment so that the books that are on that front table that are all the new fiction that are coming out, for example, the fact that they're being stocked at all is a sort of, I would guess, a stamp of approval that you can trust, really, if you trust that bookstore's stock in general, if you trust the way the bookstore's recommendations are made and the staff in there. And most bookstores now, one of their most important and frankly best-selling sections is what they call their staff pick sections, where everybody on the staff has a shelf or has a case, and they put up their favorite books of the month or the books that they're reading at the time with recommendations. And you start to identify with so-and-so's recommendations. Oh, you know, Rob over there, Quail Ridge, I really like the history that he reads, so I always go and look for his things, right? I mean, that's where an independent bookstore tends to make their niche or establish themselves with the customers, isn't the personal recommendations.
We're visiting with Nikki Leone. Nikki is the president of the North Carolina Writers Network and also a staff member of the Southern Independent Booksellers Alliance, and she's given us some of the secrets about how to get into and succeed in the bookselling business. We're going to talk to you about writing after this short break. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is DG Martin. My guest is Nikki Leone. Nikki, you're the president of the Board of Trustees of the North Carolina Writers Network, and you've been up in Chapel Hill working on that project. What's the status of writing and writers in North Carolina today?
There are so many writers in North Carolina. North Carolina is just a great state to be in if you're a writer. I think the community itself is just so vital. I mean, everybody seems to come to storytelling almost naturally. You know, it's almost instinctive, really. And pretty much everybody, I'm obviously from my accent, transplanted Yankee here. Everybody.
It's getting softer and softer every year.
Everybody I've met, though, who's from round here, as they'd say, is just inclined to speak in stories, almost. It's a fascinating thing to listen to. It's a wonderful thing to listen to. And writers in general, I think that I think everybody inherently wants a story, has a story they want told. And so I think almost everybody is a writer in some sense.
But what does the Writers Network do for this community of writers?
We try to help writers of all different levels with a variety of different needs. Beginning writers, we try to set them on the right path, you know, to help them actually with the craft of writing. We host all sorts of conferences and workshops and competitions and things like that, critiquing services to help them actually get better at telling their own stories. Those who are a little bit more established, who are actually trying to get published, say, we have a whole host of information for them, for everything from lists of agents that they can consult that have been sort of vetted by the organization to information and programs on publishing and marketing and self-publishing and the do's and don'ts, and also, frankly, connections. Most of the established writers in the state, and there are quite a lot of them, are at some point or another involved with the North Carolina Writers Network through some of its programs, either as faculty or they've served on the board or they volunteer in some fashion. So we, I think, provide a way to reach these people.
Do you have to have any particular qualifications to become a member?
No, you have to want to write. That would be the main qualification. You don't have to have written anything. As a matter of fact, when I was asked to be on the board, it was actually like 5 years ago, my first response was, you don't want me on the board. I'm not a writer with a capital W, but that wasn't a qualification at all. They knew I was involved in the industry and I loved writing, right? So,
well, you mentioned the effort or the frustration. I guess you didn't mention the frustration, but writers or prospective writers are almost universally challenged, frustrated by the efforts that come about after they've written a book that they think should be published to find a way to get it published.
That is the big question, yes.
And it's almost like talking to college basketball players about going to the pros, there's just going to be a very few who are going to make it. And how does a writer become happy by giving a good effort to get published and then happy with coming to terms with the idea that maybe it's just not going to happen this time?
Well, I think that for anybody who seriously considers themselves a writer, a career writer, the idea of success has to come first and foremost from you having produced the best possible book that you can. And if you haven't done that, then you're not going to be a success later on. Your book's not going to be a success. If you've just sort of phoned it in or, you know, written off your first draft and started looking for a publisher and not put what is frankly a quite a lot of hard work into creating the very best manuscript that you can, you're not going to have a success later on in life. But if you have, and if you're happy with the story that you told, that in and of itself is a huge success. Most people don't ever finish that first manuscript. So the fact that you finished it all is really worth some congratulations right there. Once you get to the point where you're actually shopping around your manuscript and you actually want to get published and you want to see it in a book form, then you actually sort of stop being a writer and you start becoming, for lack of a better word, a marketer or a promoter of your work. And I think a lot of writers, what's so frustrating is they're not naturally self-promotional people, right? They're private writing people. They're artistic people. And it really is a different kind of mindset than take what's basically this piece that you've worked so hard on and you've poured so much of yourself into and turn around and be a salesman for it. You know, it goes against the grain for a lot of people. I think that's what a lot of writers find difficult. The Writers Network does try to help with that and give strategies for dealing with that.
One of the options that's developed that has its upside and its downside is self-publishing.
Mm-hmm.
And what does the Writers Network tell writers who are willing to consider after finding that the market might not be there for a publisher to take their book on to publish their own through the vehicle of self-publishing?
Self-publishing has, you know, a long and actually a fairly distinguished history. I think James Joyce was self-published originally, you know, at one point or another. But I would say that self-publishing, and especially you're probably talking about the new technologies, they're called print-on-demand technologies.
One of the self-publishing options.
That's one of the most common, and certainly the fastest growing self-publishing option out there, where you can send your manuscript to a company or even upload it online, and you'll get a book out of it. The thing to remember about taking that route is that you're actually not publishing so much as you're printing when you do that. And what you are getting is a fairly reasonably priced book out of the process, something that you can then turn around and ostensibly sell to other people. But what you're not getting is you're not getting the whole host of intermediaries between that normally happen in a regular publishing process between you and your book. You're not getting house editors, you're not getting marketers, you're not getting graphic designers who are taking care of, you know, thinking about the covers and what would be appropriate. You're not getting distribution, so you're not automatically being placed in every single bookstore in the country. You are basically saying, I'm going to do all that myself. And I think most writers who go the self-publishing route are maybe not prepared, don't really realize what they're getting into. I usually tell people to publish, to self-publish a book and market it yourself effectively, just say in a region-wide, it's an investment about the same as buying a decent used car, actually. I think you need to plan on spending at least that amount of money in order to...
We're talking about $5,000 or $6,000 or something like that?
Somewhere between $5,000 and $10,000. I mean, you can do it for less and maybe get lucky, but mostly $5,000 to $10,000 is about what it takes in terms of financial commitment if you're going to be doing it all by yourself using a print-on-demand company as your publisher. So
and what are the odds? Are the odds that you might get your money back, or most of the time you're not going to get your money back?
The odds are probably, if you work really, really hard at it, you might break even.
Wow. Wow. Yeah. We're visiting with Nikki Leone. She's talking about the problems of writers and the challenges of writers and the joys of writing from her vantage point as president of the Board of Trustees of the North Carolina Writers Network. And we'll continue our discussion with her after this short break. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with my friend Nikki Leone from the Wilmington area. And she's got her hands in so many different projects that we're gonna slip around and take on all of them. One that we've one which I want to reemphasize is as president of the Board of Trustees of the North Carolina Writers Network. We'll have a link to the Writers Network webpage, and for anyone who's a writer or aspiring writer, you ought to consider being a part of that organization to for connective links for the resources that are available for the education, for the editing services that might be available, and the introduction to a community of people who might be able to help you in some fashion or another. We've also talked a little bit about the problems of book selling from your vantage point as the staff member of the Southeastern Booksellers Alliance. But Nikki, I mean, one of my favorite resources that you bring is your experience as a reader, and that you've I've forgotten the story that you tell about when you were a little girl wanting to trade a wonderful jewel.
Oh, that is
jewel.
That is a sad, true story. When I was a little girl, I was, I think like 7 years old or something. Some dear, well-meaning relative for Christmas once gave me a bunch of jewelry as a little girl, and I looked at it, and I obviously didn't act very happy, and my mother said, well, honey, you can exchange it. And so we took it into the store, and it turned out it was some sort of museum gift shop that this jewelry had been bought in, and I exchanged it for a dictionary. I actually exchanged it for a dictionary of Egyptian hieroglyphics. I'm sorry to say, it was a hopeless case even back then.
I love that story. And so if I need help with my reading hieroglyphics,
I've got the dictionary.
You
I still have them.
You can look it up. Well, that's a great story, but we want to exploit that resource here in Chapel Hill about things that you're reading or about to read or that you've heard might be good. You mentioned that one of the great things about independent booksellers is that people on the staff at every bookseller is willing to make recommendations, and that you get to know the people and you can have an idea about whether or not they might be reading things that you might like. And so I like you, so I think I'd like to read the things that you're reading.
The truth is, D.G., every single book in this country is sold on what's called the you've got to read this basis. Every single book is sold one at a time from somebody saying to somebody else, oh, I love this, you've got to read this. And that's what booksellers do, basically, for a living, is tell people, oh, you've got to read this. That's what I do. I'm really good for nothing but telling people about what they should read.
But you have to say, I know you, and you know me, and I know that this is a book you've got to read. And it's not credible if you just kind of walk down the street and somebody says, you got to read this book. Well, I don't know who you are and you don't know who I am. So that doesn't...
No. And as a matter of fact, when I worked in the bookstore, I used to say things like, I used to talk to people and ask them what they'd been reading. And that would give me an idea of the kinds of stuff they like to read. And that would usually allow me to make a guess at what they might find interesting that they hadn't heard of yet. So...
All right, well, you know some of us in Chapel Hill. What do you think I've got to be reading?
Oh, well, I brought along a few things that I'm reading because I just adore them. Actually, the book everybody's going to be reading later this summer is Pat Conroy has a new book out called South of Broad. Actually, it's not out yet. I think it's out in a couple weeks from when we're taping this. So I just know everybody's going to be reading that. But
Why? But it's because people love...
He's so iconic.
He's a John Grisham. He's the guy that...
He's beyond John Grisham. Actually,
in terms of the loyalty of his fans to his work,
in terms of his standard, he is sort of the ultimate contemporary Southern writer, I think. And the books that he have written, yes, his fans remain immensely loyal to him.
And it's been a long time.
He is just not one of those fans.
Some of his fans are just
very anxious. They're in withdrawal at this point.
So they don't care what it is with a name like that. It doesn't matter this time what he wrote. If it's got his name on it, I've got to read it if I'm a fan, you can say that,
but I think I think what you're actually saying is having read, so he's proved himself. Having read his other books, having read Water is Wide and Prince of Tides and the book about the Citadel, and there's a reason why people will snatch up Pat Conroy's next book, and it's because he's proved himself. To those readers, they've picked up his books and they have adored every single one of them. He's actually immensely what I think of as an honest and authentic writer, and I think that certainly comes through. He doesn't write marketable books, right? He writes definitely from
it's
the
definitely
heart.
Definitely literary, what we call quote literary fiction.
But at the same time, it's extremely accessible. He writes very human. About very human experiences that everybody can identify with.
And tell us what you've heard or what you know about this new book.
Well, I know that everybody's talking about it. I know that the friends of mine in the bookselling industry have managed to get their hands on some advanced copies, and they're not a lot out there, but they're all talking about it. They're all just thrilled with this new book.
And is Broad Street, is it a Charleston-based book?
Or I think so. Yeah.
So
South Abroad.
Look
for Pat Conroy.
Pat Conroy is very popular here in Chapel Hill, and it suits the style. So that'll be a big book for everybody. Go to your local independent bookseller or the Bull's Head and put your order in. Yeah. All right. So we'll be looking for that. What else you got?
Oh, well, I actually brought a book that is like one of my favorite North Carolina writers. Four Corners of the Sky by Michael Malone. You know Michael Malone.
I do, yeah. We've talked to Michael about that book.
It's a great book. Michael is like sort of my pick for the most underappreciated North Carolina writer right now. I have just adored his books ever since I first stumbled across this massive thing called Handling Sin, which he calls Don Quixote, a Southern Don Quixote story, right? And I have read every single book of his since.
You've
then.
Read all of Michael Malone's
I think I've well, read all I'm... of them at this point. And I think he is a consummate storyteller, but he's also got such a good way of setting a scene. I think that must come from his screenwriting and he wrote screenplays and soap operas and, all sorts of things. He's a jack of all trades kind of writer, and just his ability to set scene and pacing and the sort of what I would call the technical aspects of writing is just perfect, just wonderful, really. So I was so happy to have a new book by him.
What do you think of this? Tell us about Four Corners of the Sky.
Four Corners of the Sky is about, well, I like it. It's about a woman Navy pilot, which is, interesting in and of itself, who is estranged from her father and receives a very odd request from him after years of not seeing him, which then becomes the sort of saga that the book goes on. where she is supposed to fly a plane of his. Anyway, I don't want to spoil the story for
anybody. You're not going to spoil the story, but you can enrich it. I will just say that Michael talked a lot more about it than you're willing to do.
Yeah, well, good. Good. But everybody should read it.
It's set, at least in the beginning part, and centrally in eastern North Carolina, outside of Michael's Piedmont, North Carolina. It's more towards the coast and alongside the Sounds. So it's a little bit different setting, but it's definitely a North Carolina book.
It is definitely a North Carolina book. It's got he's got a great feel for the dialogue, I think, for the sort of the speech of North Carolina, my part of North Carolina, and I'm actually sort of from the coast. I just recognized sort of the area. It's all very familiar to me. So, and it's sort of a Wizard of Oz story. Did he tell you that?
Unapologetically, yes. He says it's a Wizard of Oz story. Now, I have to say that he had to tell me that.
Yeah.
And lots of times I like to find the themes myself rather than have to have the author explain it to me. But he did. Yeah, Wizard of Oz.
It's way deep in there.
So. And the thing about Michael Malone, I mean, one of the many important things about him is that he is unapologetic in his appreciation of the classic stories on which modern stories can be built. And
he actually uses them as sort of foundation for most of his books. Almost all of them have some sort of classic story foundation to them if you look hard enough. He's one of those writers that if you've ever speak to him in person, which obviously you have, he's incredibly brainy. It's a little intimidating, actually, to have a conversation with him. But at the same time, he writes they're action stories and they're murder mysteries and they're just good yarns, I guess is what you would call them. So I find him an endlessly fascinating writer.
Great. I'm glad that you've come up from Wilmington to tell us that our Orange County boy is doing well.
Oh, he's wonderful.
What else? What else you got on your reading list?
Also on my reading list is a book called The Angel's Game, and I'm only about a third of the way through this, so I can't tell you how it ends yet. This guy, Carlos Ruiz Zafón, he made a huge splash 3 or 4 years ago with a book called In the Shadow of the Wind, which is, if you're a book person, it's just my kind of book. It's all about a man who is searching for an author. He has a book that he's discovered by this writer, and he loves it, and he's searching for more books by the writer, and as he's searching, he's realizing that somebody is systematically taking up, buying up, or stealing all the books by this writer and burning them. So it's kind of a murder mystery. It's set in Seville, in Spain, right around World War II. So it's kind of historical fiction, but it's also sort of fantastic and mysterious, and it's all about books and sort of literary passions.
So this
was
written for you.
Yeah, it was written for me. Really. But it was a bestseller in Spain for apparently years and years and years before it finally was published in English in the United States. And we actually don't see a whole lot of books in translation in this country. I think somebody said once about 3% of all the books published in this country are books that were originally written in some other language. So I'm glad to see. I think we forget sometimes that there's other languages than English, and there's other stories in other places than just the United States, and so I was glad to see his book do so well. And this is I guess sort of a prequel to In the Shadow of the Wind. It takes place in the same city and with sort of the previous generation of the people who are featured in The Shadow of the Wind.
We're visiting with Nikki Leone. Nikki is a reader, a bookseller, a volunteer president of the Board of Trustees of the North Carolina Writers Network, and one of our favorite people. And we're going to continue a discussion with her after this break about places to eat, places for Chapel Hill people to eat in Wilmington. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Nikki Leone, who is a Wilmington lady who visits Chapel Hill in her role as president of the Board of Trustees of the North Carolina Writers Network. We got her to talk about that. She's on the staff of the Southeastern Booksellers Alliance, and we've got her to talk about bookselling as a business and the challenges and the rewards. And she's probably one of North Carolina's greatest reader, most enthusiastic readers, and we've gotten her to give us some wonderful recommendations. another life is as a food critic for the media down in Wilmington. And so when I asked her to come, I said, I want to exploit you and for the benefit of my friends in Chapel Hill, go to Wrightsville Beach or go to Wilmington or who are in that or some of the other beaches nearby. Are there any good places to eat in the Wilmington area?
Oh, there's a few. I actually have a sort of secret life as a restaurant critic.
You don't even do this. You have to do this under a pseudonym.
I do it under a pseudonym. Yes. So, and I walk in and they never know I'm coming, and because mostly I just want to be treated like anybody else when I go in to review a restaurant. So I think I've just eaten my way through hundreds of seafood combo platters down in Wilmington. It's actually kind of a fun experience.
Well, your latest one caught my attention because it intersected with my interest, and it said something about fried chicken on a buffet line. And so
that's a new restaurant. Any buffet line, as a rule, any buffet line is improved by the presence of fried chicken and biscuits. I think it's very hard to argue with that kind of
Want to tell us about that place just as a starter?
That place is actually pretty interesting. It's new. It's called Caribe Soul, and it just opened up on the corner of Front and Princess Street downtown.
Near
the old waterfront. If you walked out the door and looked around the corner, you would see the battleship.
Across the way.
Yeah. And it's started by these two guys, Chris and Chris, and they had Jamaican grandmothers and Southern grandmothers, and so they started this restaurant with the recipes from their grandmothers, right?
So yeah, Jamaican and Southern.
Yeah, Jamaican and American Southern. So the menu on the restaurant is actually a kind of a mix of Jamaican food, Southern food, done a little bit what I would call gussied up.
Now, who should you go there with? Is this you take your grandmother, you take your kids?
You can take anybody there. Yeah, well, it's it's a very beautiful building, and this is right in downtown historic Wilmington. There's tons of beautiful wood detailing, and it's a gorgeous place to just go and sit. So it's not exactly like a Chuck E. Cheese's family kind of restaurant, but it is what I would call upscale casual, right? So you could take family there for special occasions, and you could take your date there, and you could certainly have a business lunch there. They're open for lunch and dinner.
Tell us something one more time.
Caribe Soul is
Caribe.
Yes.
Carolina Bay or Caribe?
Caribbean.
Caribbean.
Yes. Caribe. Caribe
Soul. Caribe. All right. That's great. Now, we don't have a lot of time, and I was going to exploit you on getting a longer list of places near Wrightsville and near Wilmington and near Figure Eight and Carolina Beach and all of these great places that most of them are in Wilmington. But if I tell you I'm just going to be there one night and I want the supreme, in your view, the supreme dining experience, where are you going to send me?
Oh, that's like asking me what my favorite book is, really. Mm-hmm. And I have to say, what are you in the mood to eat?
Well, give me one of them. You can put the ifs in there and then give me the
There place. Is, if you don't mind spending a little money, probably my favorite restaurant in the town is a place called Portland Grill. It is one of the few places that I think actually deserves a 5-star rating from, New York restaurant critic standards, a 5-star rating. I have never been there when I haven't had food that's been absolutely fantastic from the appetizer all the way through to the dessert. Even the side salads, the little things that most restaurants put along the side just to sort of decorate the plate, even all that stuff is fantastically prepared. And I've never regretted the bill.
It's a lot of money, but
I've never regretted a cent of it. So the Portland Grill, they're in the Luminous Station Shopping Center. They're actually close to Wrightsville Beach, but on the land side.
Well, we got time for one more. And what about when you go to the beach, you go with your family, with might be older people and grandparents, and all the way down to little kids. Are there places that you've run into that are really good food, accommodating, and reasonably priced so that you can take your family there?
Yeah, there actually are a fair amount of places like that. Right on Wrightsville Beach, there's the Causeway Cafe for lunch and breakfast. They're not open for dinner. And if you're actually down on the beach, one of the best places to get food is Robert's Grocery. And the best thing you could probably do is stop in and pick up a bucket of fried chicken from Robert's Grocery and just go eat it out on the blanket on the beach. That's one of my favorite things to do. Those would be my two picks for
food. Those are great.
Food.
Those are great picks. I guess we're still in mourning about the loss of the middle of the island.
Yes.
The pancakes in the morning.
Yes, yes, we are in mourning about that. I'm sorry to see them go.
Well, we'll get you back and give us some more recommendations on books to read and on places to eat in Wrightsville Beach on how to be a good, successful writer and get our books published. All of these things from our friend from the Wilmington area, Nikki Leone. I want to thank you very much for joining
us. Thanks
for
having me here.
And thanks to all y'all for listening. I'll be back same time tomorrow.